Your host, Joe Garagiola. A bit later this half hour, an inspiring career story from Joe Walker. He's a sports announcer in Miami who's been blind since he was 1 year old. Also, another primary preview from Wisconsin. And just 3 minutes from now, American soldiers under siege at Quezon give us a very personal description of what it's like while they watch and wait.
If one you think is true ever turns his back on you, you still got a place in my heart. If the years should make you cry,
music by Dean Martin.
Made Easter reservations?
Easter reservations?
Call your FTD florist and make Easter flower reservations now.
Within the past 24 hours, U.S. Marines have engaged in several probing actions outside the walls of the American base at Quezon. Basically, however, the situation remains the same. It's a time of watching and waiting for the promised major North Vietnamese offensive. And for our report, here is Jack Russell, NBC News, Quezon.
The night is a time for watchfulness at Quezon. It is then that the enemy creeps closer to Marine lines. If an attack comes, it almost certainly will be in darkness. Flares occasionally illuminate the ground. The sounds of the night are the explosion of enemy mortar shells, the plunk-like bang of a Marine M79 grenade launcher, or an aerial assault by helicopters against North Vietnamese troops. The Marines are alert this night, as they have been for more than 2 months, guarding their combat base, waiting for the enemy.
What's your name?
P.S.C. Anderson, David B.
And where are you from?
Avoca, Iowa.
What do you see out here tonight?
We see flashlight actions from the NVA working through their trenches.
About how far are they out there?
300 to 400 meters.
Since you've been up at Quezon, have they moved closer, or are they remain about the same distance from your front line here.
I think their trench action is the same. I think they're tunneling, though.
In other words, they're digging underneath you or trying to dig underneath you.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, thank you. What's your name?
Lance Corporal Greg Penta.
And where are you from?
Plainville, Connecticut.
What's your job on this line?
I'm on the 50 caliber, and if we get a heavy ground attack, I fire straight down our lines to stop any enemy from getting into the trench line.
Have you seen any movement tonight?
No, we haven't. They've been firing illumination. I haven't seen anything myself tonight.
You've been up here during 2 months of the heavy bombardment of Quezon. Do you feel it's slackened off a bit now?
It's slackened off very much. We hardly get any incoming at all during the day now.
How about the night?
Oh, not that much at all. Not more than 10 rounds, I don't think, come in at night.
What do you think the enemy might do yet? Do you think they might probe you, or do you think they're getting ready to withdraw, or what?
In my opinion, I think they could possibly probe us, but I don't think they'd pull any heavy ground attack here. And I think they might keep up with rocket and artillery attacks.
Okay, well, thank you very much. What's your name?
Stephen Allen Riddle.
And where are you from?
I'm from all over the world, actually. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, London, England, you name it, I've been there.
Where's your home right now?
My home right now is in London.
But you are an American.
Most definitely.
You're operating this listening device here in this trench tonight. Could you tell me exactly what it does?
The machine is designed to pick up troop movement or any kind of vehicle movement, whether it be trucks, tanks, or jeeps, anything of that sort.
Can you actually hear a man walking out there?
Yes, you can hear the man walking. According to the training of the machine, it's not an actual footstep that you hear. It's a variation in the static that you can detect with practice.
Is this hard on your ears, listening to this device all night?
The prescribed amount of time for a person who's been working with the machine is about 30 to 40 minutes.
If you listen too long, what happens?
Well, like I said, if you listen too long, your mind tends to float away from it. You start thinking about things like back home and your girlfriend. And that means you're doing your job, so you just go call your buddy and tell him to get on it.
Since you've been out here, have you picked up enemy movement?
Yes, we have. We picked up quite a bit since we started. 14 confirmed kills thus far, and quite a few secondaries from our own fire, which varied from M79s to M60s to artillery. Something I'll never forget.
Well, thank you. Jack Russell, NBC News, reporting for Monitor from Quezon.
Back home, presidential election time draws nearer, and we'll help you keep in touch with the latest developments in another primary preview from Wisconsin in just 1 minute.
Jesse Tutu, Monitor.
And to put that another way, just stay on the Monitor beacon.
Hello, I'm Adam West. Did you know that more than
32,000 students in the South are Celsius?
Every year, more than 32,000.
Thank you.
Here's more of Monitor at exactly 17 minutes and 41 seconds after the hour. Time for another primary preview. Here's a brief pause, and then we'll switch live to hear the latest word on Wisconsin's presidential primary election from Russ Ward, NBC News in Milwaukee.
Richard Nixon was in Milwaukee today, not really campaigning for the Tuesday primary. His campaign effort wrapped up 3 days ago. Today's appearance was more of a frosting. Nixon is sharing the Republican ballot Tuesday with Ronald Reagan and Harold Stassen. But the enthusiastic welcome given the former vice president this afternoon would indicate no contest. As he arrived for the reception, Nixon was asked what makes the Wisconsin race important to him.
Well, it's important from the standpoint of getting a good Republican turnout, although now it's we have the 30 delegates. I think we have a pretty good chance to win it.
There's much talk here about the crossover vote, Republicans going to the Democrats to embarrass Mr. Johnson.
That's a tradition, and I hope that we can keep it down.
Do you think it will hurt you?
Yes, sir.
The crossover will hurt some, says Nixon. But this afternoon's turnout still shows a sizable, faithful following. Mr. Nixon, assured of a Republican victory Tuesday, no matter what happens on the Democratic side, is flying back to New York tonight. His next campaign target, Ohio, and a speech and news conference Tuesday in Cincinnati. This is Russ Ward, NBC News, Milwaukee.
On Tuesday, NBC Radio and Television brings you the most comprehensive, complete coverage of the Wisconsin presidential primary.
If I had told her that I loved her, she would have stayed till who knows when. But I guess she couldn't understand it when I said I want to be your friend. Because a friend could never doubt you or ever put you on that high. And now I wonder what you're doing tonight.
Oh, yes, I wonder. Oh, yes, I wonder.
Light Singers on Monitor.
Has this ever happened to you? You're driving along, and then the monotony of driving gets you down. You're droopy. You've got the driving drowsies, and that could be dangerous. Well, fight back. Pull over and take No-Doze. It's got the strongest stimulant you can buy without a prescription, and it's not habit-forming. no dose. No car should be without it.
On the World in Washington Tonight at 9:35 Eastern Time, NBC News correspondent Robert McCormick and Congressman Wright Patman of Texas will discuss the significance of President Johnson's address to the nation, which we will carry in the previous half hour. Representative Patman is the chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee, as well as vice chairman of the Joint House and Senate Economic Committee. You know, in my years in the major leagues and later as a broadcaster of sports, I've been lucky to be an eyewitness of many stories of triumph over incredible handicaps, but fellows who could hang tough. And I think you've got to include Joe Walker's story as one of the most inspirational. Joe Walker is blind. He's been blind since he was 1 year old. And yet, his burning love for sports gave him the determination which helped him become not only an active player, but a sports announcer. He describes just how he accomplished both as he talks with Monitor reporter Bill O'Donnell in Miami.
Joe, what has created this unusual, if I can call it that, interest that you have in professional athletics, amateur athletics, and sports in particular?
I was a great listener of the radio as a little boy. You see, like a lot of kids when they were young, they would go out and jump rope or play ball or do something. But my main companion was my radio. And I started listening to prize fights as a little boy, and I loved them. But then I started listening to baseball games, so therefore I got interested in baseball.
Joe, as a professional sports announcer here in Miami, just actually, what do you do?
I only do two sports shows a day, and these shows consist of the results of sports events, and like if there are any trades or any upcoming sports events, we talk about those.
Just how long ago did this particular interest, not in sports, but in announcing, occur, and why did you decide to go into it?
Well, I guess can say that I always loved radio. I always wanted to be a radio announcer. There was always somebody that I wanted to be like. But my main first interest in life was I wanted to be a baseball player. I wanted to play second base for the Yankees. And I played on the school baseball team, and when I woke up to the reality that I would never be able to see, which would never allow me to play baseball, I decided I wanted to be the next best thing close to baseball, and that's a sports broadcaster.
Joe, you mentioned you played baseball in school. Being sightless, how were you able to play the game?
Well, this was through a marvelous invention of one of our instructors at the school, Mr. Otis Knowles. Before Mr. Knowles came there, there was no system where the blind kids could play any kind of sport. So what did he do? He somehow managed to get a hold to a ball with a bell in it. And he had this system manufactured. You could hear the ball coming, and you could decide whether you want to swing at it or not. Then he also had a system where he had some bases. Each base had a bell. There was a bell for first base. There was a bell for second base. There was a bell for third base. There was a bell for home plate, and they all sounded different. So when you hit the ball, you know just which base you wanted to go to. But then it got to where we didn't really need the bells because everybody began to find out where the bases were ordinarily.
Joe, in a sense, you have achieved an ambition to become a sports announcer as you do here in Miami. Do you have any greater ambitions?
Well, I don't want to stay in Miami. I'll be honest with you. Miami just isn't my cup of tea as far as living here permanently. I'm a funny man about anything. I believe that if you're going to be into a profession, you ought to get to the very top of it. Now, what I'd like to do, I'd like to be a network sports announcer, either a network news reporter, or if possible, I'd like to work in a town where there's a major league ball team.
You'd like to be a network sports announcer. What would you like to do in that type of network position? What do you think you could do?
Well, I think in the position as a network sports announcer, I could do a similar show, similar to the one that is done by Frank Gifford and Joe Chiargiola does, or that Phil Rizzuto does.
Joe, although you are sightless, how many sports events over the course of the year do you cover yourself personally?
Well, the Super Bowl, the exhibition baseball, the Miami Marlins baseball, the University of Miami football, and the Miami Dolphins football, and occasionally a basketball game.
Joe Walker, as a sightless sports announcer here in Miami, may I say, as I said to you before we went on the air, actually, you're an inspiration to me, and I'm sure many, many more people. And may your further ambitions be realized.
Thank you very much, Bill.
This is Bill O'Donnell for Monitor Sports.
Joe, I hope it works out for you. I tell you, a lot of guys would like to have the kind of insides you got. Tremendous. Tremendous man. Thank you. That one's new, composed by Elmer Bernstein and played by Al Caiola's orchestra. The title, The Scalp Hunter's Theme. Boy, for guys who go into barbershops just for a shine, I don't like that name. But don't be fooled. Monitor's friendly, a wonderful companion at home or on the road every weekend on NBC Radio. In the area of Southern Florida, you can hear us on station WIOD. And after all stations say hello, Monitor continues. This is Joe Garagio.
Don't go away, there's more to come, more to interest everyone. Just stay tuned, we'll be back soon with more.
Monitor New York, your weekend sound on WNBC New York.
A former bounty hunter returns home to find his partner dead. Millie Perkins and Jack Nicholson star in The Shooting, tonight at 11:30.
Watch the New York television premiere of The Shooting on the Sunday Film Festival tonight at 11:30 on WNBC-TV, Channel 4, New York.
On Monitor next, the voice of one of our most prominent ladies of song down through the years, Miss Ella Fitzgerald, and the song, I Taught Him Everything He Knows.
I taught him everything he knows, and then what did he do? He turned to someone else and taught her everything he knew. The way things to do, he learned from me. I taught him love's all that matters on this earth. Now he has left me, and what was it all worth? I thought that he'd be true to me, but that's the way it goes. She ought to thank me, 'cause I taught him everything he
Monitor music now, as the Pat Williams Orchestra describes the look of love. ¶¶
And it's spring, all right, and here's another sure sign. It was 87 degrees in Los Angeles this week, and two men robbed a bank there, and they were caught shortly afterward. They made just one little slip. See, they were riding along in their car, but they were wearing ski masks. Well, the only American ski instructor in Norway tells us about his job and predicts the competitive future of U.S. skiers right after you meet a small circle of friends.
By my side through thick and thin. If you say, you will say, we can let our love begin. In return, take this heart of mine. Just remember, you'll never find a heart so kind or another love so fine. Never before was I free to fall for anyone. Could I see it all within you? Now it's you. Make a vow here and now. You will always be my own. Tell me you will be true, and I won't be left alone. In return, take this heart of mine. Just remember. For anyone, never before could I see it all within you. Now let you.
Easter reservations?
Easter reservations?
Call your FTD florist and make Easter flower reservations now.
For many years, European skiers, particularly Scandinavians, have had a real stranglehold on international honors in this sport. Case in point, the recent Olympics. On the other side of the coin, American skiers in the winning circle have been rare. In fact, the U.S. ski team failed to pick up a single medal at the Winter Games. But coaches and expert observers predict all this is going to change. Michael Brady, the only American ski instructor in Norway, is optimistic about the future as he describes his duties to monitor reporter John Cannon in Oslo.
Michael, we are correct in saying that you are, for all practical knowledge that anyone has, the only American instructing here.
Yeah, at the present time, I am the only American that I know of who is actively instructing in Norway. I am also qualified as a cross-country racing coach by the Norwegian Ski Federation and teach Norwegians in this capacity.
Isn't the skiing here kind of a way of transporting yourself?
No longer in the large cities. The postmen, linemen, telegraph linemen, electricians, woodsmen, and so on in the rural districts still ski because they have to. However, it is a form of enjoyment only or competition for the city dwellers.
But that's the tradition, isn't it? That's where it all started, was people had to use skis to get places.
This is true. People had to use skis to get places, much as American trappers and so on used snowshoes at one time.
It is interesting the way skiing instruction is handled here. One doesn't go at 10 o'clock in the morning generally here and get skiing instruction. Everybody goes to work, and you're one of them, aren't you?
Well, I work from 8:30 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon, 5 days a week, and every other Saturday. And like most Norwegians, I can ski in the evenings and on Saturdays and Sundays. And this is also when most instruction is available or is planned in the large urban areas. There are a few ski areas like Geilo and Voss, which have full-time year-round instruction, or rather season-round instruction.
So the tradition here is to do your job, and then you can go skiing after that, huh?
Well, on a good evening in Oslo, there may be between 5,000 and 7,000 people out skiing. The population of Oslo is 400,000.
We note here in Oslo that people walk around in ski clothes and with skis, carrying skis, any time of the day. In the morning, right in the middle of the business day, it's a common sight.
It's a very common sight. Generally, housewives, mothers will take their children skiing during the day, and papa will go out in the evening with the kids who've been in school.
How do you approach people who have never skied before? What are the basics you give them?
Well, I give them the basics following the technique of the Norwegian Ski School, which bases learning on something they know how to do before. They can walk, so we teach them to walk on skis with loose, flexible bindings where only their toe is fastened to the ski. They perform a walk-like movement, and then it's simply a matter of going through the necessary steps to progress.
Norwegians themselves don't take a great deal of instruction, do they?
No, this is the biggest problem of the Norwegian Ski School, is trying to get Norwegians to take instruction. They believe they know how, every one of them.
Do they?
No. They very sorely need instruction, some of them. And when only a quarter of the population skis regularly, this thus means that three-quarters of the population either does not ski or skis very poorly.
Americans love to take instruction, don't they? When they come here, they want you to teach them.
Well, Americans are very eager learners. Perhaps one of the best groups of students that I have had while I've been teaching here in Norway.
Michael, you live here. This is the home of champion skiers competitively. What is the potential future for American skiers as competitors?
It's excellent if they want to spend the amount of time necessary to reach the top. There are several Americans who are either at the top or so close that they're beginning to worry the Europeans. Mike Gallagher from Kellington, Vermont, is one of the Americans that has really begun to worry the Scandinavians by taking second and third places in races here this winter. Gallagher is a cross-country racer. He has been an excellent track runner, which simply shows that the United States' largest chance, percentage-wise, lies in the Nordic events, particularly in cross-country racing. America has always turned out top track people and has always taken medals in the Summer Olympics in track. Why not in cross-country skiing? It can be done, and it will be done.
Well, Mike, it is remarkable, almost incredible, that an American would come here to the home of skiing and tell even the natives how to do it. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks, and I hope to see lots more Americans over here.
We've been talking to Michael Brady. This is John Cannon from Oslo, Norway, for Monitor.
I'd like to add that just a few weeks ago, right here on Monitor, Bob Beatty, the U.S. Olympic alpine skiing coach, voiced similar optimism to that was just offered by Michael Brady. So, you know, maybe the old Brooklyn Dodgers cry of wait till next year is appropriate for our young, swiftly improving alpine skiers. Let's hope so, anyhow. Chris Economaki, about 4 minutes from now on Sport of Speed, another regular feature here on the Monitor Beach. Back with Monitor at 16 minutes before the hour, and just in the nick of time, or else you would have missed Barbara Streisand.
He could show me things I've never dreamed of, things I've never thought of before. days I've wasted waiting for tomorrow. Some were set time, some were the place, some were the world, some were the face. He could show me, he could show me, he could show me.
Monitor presents Sport of Speed. It's time for your weekend checkpoint with Chris Economaki, with action from the world of auto racing. Brought to you by the refiners of world-famous Pennsylvania-grade crude oils. Chris will be along in just a moment. But first of all, let me ask you a question that people quite often ask us. What's so great about Pennsylvania-grade crude motor oils? All right, let's put it this way. Some oils take several days to produce. Pennsylvania crudes took 1 million years. Nature has never produced a crude oil like it. Pennsylvania crudes have a unique molecular structure that stands up to the heat of high speeds. Can you imagine what happens to lesser oils when they're thrashed around several thousand times a minute at turnpike speeds? Pennsylvania-grade crude motor oils never get so stirred up that they forget what they're supposed to do. So for the good of your engine, insist on Pennsylvania-grade crude motor oils. And by the way, all of you sports car enthusiasts, when is your club holding its next rally? You can get a complete rally kit with checkpoint signs, windshield numbers, and sanctioned scoring slips from the Pennsylvania-grade Crude Oil Association. For just $1, you get 6 big checkpoint signs, windshield stickers numbered 1 through 100, and a pad of 120 rally scoring slips. Send your dollar to Checkpoint, Box 96, Oil City, Pennsylvania, zip code 16301. Now, here's Chris Economaki.
In Friday's meeting of the Automobile Competitions Committee in New York City, it was decided that effective April 15th, that everybody in NASCAR stock car racing may have 2 4-barrel carburetors. But today at Atlanta, Cale Yarborough of Timmonsville, South Carolina, Mercury's best speed salesman, made it 2 straight on the Atlanta International Raceway, winning the 9th annual Atlanta 500. Leroy Yarborough of Columbia, South Carolina was a close second, both in Mercury Cyclones. Donnie Allison of Hueytown, Alabama was third in a 68 Ford, and Charging Charlie Glotzback of Georgetown, Indiana was next. Darrell Derringer, Richard Petty, Buddy Baker, Bobby Isaac, and Sam McQuag, along with Butch Hartman, rounded out the top 10. Fastest qualifier, Bobby Allison, was with the leaders late in the race when he cut a right front tire and turned into the crash wall at high speed. He was uninjured, but his 1968 Ford Torino, managed by Fred Lorenzen, was badly damaged. A tremendous crowd watched the race, which was studded by 11 caution flags, which slowed the action for 77 laps and held the average speed to 125.564 miles per hour. Out in Las Vegas, Nevada, round 2 of United States Road Racing Championship was held, and Bobby Unser was the victor. And this put him in the point lead for the United States Auto Club National Championship, with Phoenix next on April 7th. Mario Andretti was second, Joe Leonard third, Lloyd Ruby fourth, and George Snyder fifth. Rounding out the top 12 finishers, Bill Vukovich, Gordon Johncock, Art Pollard, Porky Rakowitz, Gary Bettenhausen, and Roger McCluskey. Unser led laps 1 through 3, and then Mario Andretti took over and led through the 44th lap when he stopped for fuel. Unser took the lead then and was never headed. Dan Gurney was the fastest qualifier, but went out on the first lap when a rock hit his car and damaged it. A.J. Foyt was out of the race, losing oil on the 21st lap. Down in Mexico City today, a gentleman by the name of Moises Solana, a part-time high-life player and a part-time racing driver, captured the first United States Road Racing Championship in a car that he'd only seen 3 days ago, a brand-new automobile. Skip Scott was second in a new Lola, and fastest qualifier Peter Revson was third. Fourth was Sam Posey, Bud Morley was fifth, and Lothar Mönchenbacher, who led the first lap, was sixth after a spin. And in Reading, Pennsylvania, the United States Auto Club Eastern Sprint Car opener this afternoon, Larry Dixon was an all-the-way leader in the 30-lapper after starting third. Ray Tilley, a super-modified grad, was next, followed by Bill Peterball, Raleigh Beal, Bobby Adamson, Hal Minyard, Ted Wise, Greg Weld, and Tom Corbin. It was a busy day in motorsports around the country. This is Chris Economaki for Monitor Sports.
Sport of Speed with Chris Economaki is brought to you twice each weekend by the many famous brands of Pennsylvania-grade crude oil. For the lasting good of your engine, insist on a Pennsylvania motor oil. This is Mel Allen for Monitor Sports. Be sure to hear Monitor's other auto racing feature, World of Wheels, every Saturday and Sunday evening.
Keep in step with Monitor.
When driving gets monotonous, you can get the driving drowsies. Don't take extra chances. Pull over and fight back with No-Doze. No-Doze has the strongest stimulant you can buy without a prescription. And it's not habit-forming. No-Doze. No car should be without it.
Stay tuned for NBC Monitor News, which is next, followed immediately by President Johnson's special address to the nation. This is Joe Garagiola.
At this time, we interrupt our FM programming to bring you the news and a special program with the President of the United States. This is WNBC, AM and FM, New York.
President Johnson speaks to the American people by radio and TV immediately following this news broadcast, but already there are hints that he may announce plans for de-escalating the war. American military sources in Saigon said a partial halt is in the works, but it is not a complete thing. For more on the president's talk, here's NBC News correspondent Robert Gorowski in Washington.
The president's speech is expected to be his most significant on Vietnam since he outlined his peace formula in San Antonio last September. In the intervening 6 months, the communists have showed no inclination to negotiate a settlement. The question tonight is whether Mr. Johnson feels the best way to end the war is through escalation or de-escalation. The president has been known in the past to offer both, offering new proposals to pacify hawks and doves at the same time. It may be his formula tonight. What Mr. Johnson says could have a bearing on the domestic political scene. His popularity has never been lower. It's been suggested that a speech coming only 32 hours before the voters in Wisconsin start casting ballots on their presidential preferences could be a factor in the outcome of the Democratic primary. Mr. Johnson is opposed in Wisconsin by Senator Eugene McCarthy. The senator will decide after tonight's speech how political he thought it was, then perhaps may request an opportunity on the radio and television networks to reply. Robert Gorowski, NBC News, Washington.
It is early Monday morning in Vietnam as President Johnson prepares to speak. Air Force fighter bombers have returned from missions over North Vietnam, but it is not known if they ranged deep into the enemy heartland or restricted their efforts to targets along the demilitarized zone. Earlier this year, the president imposed a limited bombing pause on the Hanoi Haiphong area as a signal to the North Vietnamese that the United States was interested in de-escalation and peace talks. That ban was removed after the Tet Offensive and the North Vietnamese continued to build up forces around Khe Sanh. The four remaining F-111s based in Southeast Asia did not take part in Monday morning's action. There are unofficial reports that they have been grounded pending the outcome of safety checks by a Pentagon team. Two of the swept-wing fighters have been lost in less than a week. North Vietnam claims to have shot them down. The U.S. is neither confirming or denying Hanoi's claims. In the ground war, the Viet Cong hit the big Na Be oil depot and military complex outside Saigon with 90 rounds of mortar fire. 15 miles north of the capital, enemy artillery and rocket fire ripped into the U.S. Army headquarters at Long Binh. Only light casualties and minor damage were reported by the U.S. military command. Senator Eugene McCarthy, campaigning in Wisconsin, said tonight he believes it would take 6 months of negotiations to achieve a viable coalition government in South Vietnam, but the fighting could be scaled down sooner than that. McCarthy said the biggest obstacle would be overcoming the opposition of the Saigon government. South Vietnam's President Thieu as much as confirmed McCarthy's prognosis when he told students at Saigon University that nothing could force his government into accepting a coalition with the communists. Thieu threatened to declare a general mobilization of all South Vietnamese men between 18 and 40 if the limited call-up of 135,000 fresh troops proves insufficient to achieve victory. Military advisors of the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization called for the increased military effectiveness to counter the insurgency and what they called open aggression in the treaty area. The advisors issued a communique after a two-day meeting in Wellington, New Zealand. Tuesday, the foreign ministers of the CETO nations, including Secretary of State Dean Rusk, will begin their talks. More in a moment.
Psychologist Dr. Joyce Brothers says, if the thought of moving to a new community makes you want to trade in your stomach, relax. You've got a little bit of a normal condition called neophobia, or fear of the new, end quote. Well, Greyhound van lines won't change your phobia overnight, but they'll certainly show you how a smooth, efficient moving company can help your nerves and calm your stomach. They're nationwide moving experts, backed by over 50 years of Greyhound experience on the highway. Call Greyhound van lines. You'll relax when you leave the moving to us.
National leaders of the Young Democratic Clubs of America backed President Johnson at the conclusion of their National Committee meeting in Washington. The leaders adopted a resolution supporting the president's Vietnam policy without vocal opposition. The South African government says it has no intention of releasing 30 prisoners from the neighboring territory of Southwest Africa who are under sentence of death for alleged terrorism. A 1,300-word statement handed to Secretary General U Thant rejected outright the UN Security Council resolution demanding the release of the prisoners. A pro-government newspaper in Johannesburg hints that South Africa may withdraw from the UN because it claims that any information favorable to South Africa is summarily rejected and ignored by the world body. Once again, the hour's top story, President Johnson addresses the nation on radio and TV immediately following this broadcast, and he is expected to outline steps for de-escalating the Vietnam War. Dean Mell, NBC News, New York.
Listen again on the hour when Greyhound Van Lines brings you NBC Monitor News.
Can there ever be too much of a good thing? Take Liebfraumilch, that lovely light German white wine. 500 different brands of Liebfraumilch enter the States every year. And the one I think you like best of all is Liebfraumilch Cathedral by Franz Weber, because Liebfraumilch Cathedral is a natural Rhine wine. From grape to bottle, it's one pure, delicious wine. Lots of the other 500 brands blend different wines to make their Liebfraumilch. Oh, some of them sell at twice the price of Franz Weber Liebfraumilch Cathedral. But this delightful, soft, very drinkable Liebfraumilch Cathedral, perfect for every kind of dining, would delight at any price. Like great wines from all over the world, Liebfraumilch Cathedral by Franz Weber carries just one little label you surely recognize. A Monsieur Henri selection, imported exclusively by Monsieur Henri Wines Limited, New York, New York, but of course.
Monitor New York, your weekend sound on WNBC New York. Thank you.